Money Psychology. Money Psychology.
Every time you reach for your wallet, check your bank balance, or make a financial decision, you're not just dealing with money, you're reliving every money lesson, fear, and belief you absorbed before you were old enough to understand what any of it meant. I'm Elliot Graves, and this is Money Psychology, where we explore how your earliest financial experiences created the money mindset that controls your financial life today. Welcome to Money Psychology. Today we're exploring a topic that I think is, well, it's a bit of a ghost in the machine of our financial lives. We're calling this episode The Financial Mirage, and it's all about decoding the impact of our childhood friendships on our money behavior today. It's such a fascinating area. I mean, have you ever stopped to wonder how much the kids you played with on the playground are still influencing the financial decisions you make as an adult? That's the question, isn't it? It immediately made me think back. I had this one friend whose family had, you know, what seemed like everything. The newest video games, the brand name clothes. I didn't consciously think, I want that, but looking back, I can see how it shaped my definition of what normal or successful looked like, right? For me, it was the opposite. My closest friend's family was always incredibly frugal, and I remember absorbing this sense of almost guilt around spending money on anything that wasn't a necessity. It's a feeling that, if I'm being honest, still pops up for me today, decades later. And that's the core of what we're unraveling. This invisible thread that connects those early experiences, the socioeconomic status of our friends, the peer pressure to fit in, the financial aspirations we absorbed by osmosis to our adult lives. Exactly. We're going to dive into that complex web, exploring how those childhood connections can create a kind of mirage, a distorted view of wealth, success, and security that many of us are still navigating. It's a subtle but incredibly powerful force. I have a feeling this conversation is going to uncover some things that are deeply hidden for a lot of us, myself included. It's going to be an eye-opening discussion. And when we talk about this mirage, I think it's important to get specific. Is it just envy? Is it just, you know, a simple case of keeping up with the Joneses starting early? Or is it something deeper than that? Oh, it's so much deeper. I think it's less about conscious envy and more about calibration. Your friend's financial reality becomes the calibration for your own internal sense of normalcy. It's the silent benchmark against which you measure everything else, often without even realizing you're doing it. The silent benchmark. That's it. So for me, with my frugal friend, the normal I absorbed was a constant state of, let's call it, financial vigilance. A dollar spent on a treat wasn't just a dollar. It was a deviation from the status quo.
Exactly.
And that's a classic example of status quo bias, but applied in a way we never talk about. We usually think of it as not wanting to change our bank or our own habits. But what if the status quo we're protecting isn't even ours? What if it's one we inherited from a childhood friend? Wow. That lands heavily. So you're saying I might be, in some small way, still trying to live up to their family's financial rules. It's possible, isn't it? And think about your experience, the opposite one, the friend with everything. The normal you calibrated to was one of abundance, of acquisition. Does that mean you feel a sense of failure or unease if your adult life doesn't match that level of effortless consumption? It manifests as a kind of restlessness, a feeling that I should be further along, that getting the next thing will finally make me feel like I've arrived. But the goalpost always seems to move. Because the goalpost was never yours to begin with. It was set on a different playing field, in a different game. And this ties into another cognitive shortcut, the familiarity bias. Okay, explain that. How does that fit in?
Well, we gravitate toward what we know. It feels safer. So if your childhood was filled with observing a friend's family navigate their finances with ease and lots of spending, that pattern feels familiar. It feels like the right way to do things. The same goes for the opposite.
If you saw constant penny-pinching, that behavior, that anxiety, feels like the responsible and familiar path, even if it's causing you distress today. So, it's not just the things they had, it's the behaviors we witnessed, the conversations we overheard, the casual way one friend's parents might talk about booking a vacation versus the tense, closed-door meetings another friend's parents might have had about bills.
That's the core of it. We absorbed the emotional temperature around money. Was it a source of joy and freedom, or was it a source of stress and limitation?
That emotional blueprint is incredibly sticky. It becomes the background music to every financial decision you make for the rest of your life, until you consciously decide to change the track.
Change the track.
Wow. That's such a simple way to put it, but it feels so monumental. Because most of the time, you don't even realize a song is playing, right? It's just noise. It's the hum of the refrigerator. You don't notice it until it stops.
Or until someone points it out.
And that hum, that background track, is often tuned to the frequency of social comparison. It's not just that we absorbed their emotional temperature, we immediately used it to check our own. It's a fundamental human driver. So, me looking at my friend with the frugal family, I wasn't just observing. I was actively, if unconsciously, comparing. And what did that do? Did it make me feel, I don't know, superior? Or just anxious that I was doing something wrong by wanting more? It could be both, even at the same time. Psychologists talk about upward and downward social comparison. When you were looking at your friend with everything, that was classic upward comparison. You're looking at someone you perceive as better off. And that can fuel aspiration, sure, but it more often fuels that restlessness you mentioned. That feeling of being perpetually behind.
Yeah,
perpetually behind. That's the phrase for it.
But with your frugal friend, you were engaging in downward comparison. Looking at someone you perceived as having less.
And that's a tricky one. It doesn't always make you feel better. For you, it sounds like it created a sense of guilt, a fear of being seen as wasteful or ostentatious by the very people whose validation you sought.
Oh, 100%. I remember getting a new pair of Nike sneakers for my birthday once. A huge deal in my family. And I actively remember feeling ashamed to wear them to his house. I thought his parents would judge me, or that he would feel bad. The joy of the gift was just erased by this comparison anxiety. And think of the lesson that lodges in your brain from that one single event. A new nice thing doesn't equal joy. It equals social anxiety. It equals the risk of damaging a relationship. How could that not follow you into adulthood when you're thinking about buying a car or a house?
It becomes a line of code in the program. New purchase equals potential social friction. It's exhausting, actually, to think about how many of those little moments created the operating system I'm still running.
It is. And for me, with my friend's family, the upward comparison created a different kind of code. It wasn't about the things themselves, but the ease with which they acquired them. Money was never discussed as a problem. It was just a tool, a means to an end. So my code became, if there is friction or stress around a financial decision, you are failing.
Whoa. So for you, the goal isn't even the thing. It's the feeling of effortlessness you observed in someone else?
Precisely. It's chasing a ghost. I'm not trying to replicate their bank account. I'm trying to replicate a feeling I projected onto them as a 10-year-old. It's a complete mirage. And it highlights that the most dangerous comparisons aren't about the numbers in an account, but about the narratives we build around them.
That really crystallizes it, the narrative. Because the story I told myself about my friend's family was one of virtue. The story you told yourself about yours was one of success. And we've spent our adult lives trying to write ourselves into a story that was never our own to begin with.
And we treat that story like a biography when it's actually fiction.
The first step, really, is just acknowledging that. Seeing the mirage for what it is. Not a real destination, just heat on the pavement.
So how do you stop driving towards it?
I mean, for anyone listening who's having one of these aha moments, realizing they're chasing their childhood friend's version of normal, where do they even begin to change course? It feels so foundational.
It is foundational. And I don't think it's about some dramatic hard pivot.
It's not about waking up tomorrow and saying, I'm a different person now. I think it's about auditing your reactions. The next time you feel that pang of anxiety about a purchase, or that restless urge to upgrade something, just pause.
Just for a second.
Just for a second. And ask a simple question. Is this feeling mine? Or is it a 10-year-old's echo?
Is this feeling mine?
Wow, that's a powerful question. It's about separating your present self from that ghost, as you called it. I think for me, the takeaway is also about forgiveness. Forgiving yourself for the financial missteps you made while you were essentially operating on someone else's software. Oh, that's huge. Because there's so much shame wrapped up in this. Shame for not having enough, or shame for spending too much. But when you realize you weren't even holding the map, that you were navigating with a child's drawing of a treasure that doesn't exist, it allows for a little bit of grace. A little bit of grace. I think that's the perfect place to start. It's not about erasing the past. You can't. It's about understanding the mirage so you can finally start to see the real landscape of your own financial life. What you actually value. What your definition of security or abundance looks like, separate from everyone else. And that landscape is going to look different for every single person. It's not about finding the right map. It's about finally giving yourself permission to draw your own. It's a lifelong process, but at least you're heading towards something real. Something that's actually yours.
Something that's yours.
What a concept. This has been truly an eye-opening conversation.
It really has.
And I think it's a reminder that our financial lives are never just about the numbers. They're about the stories we tell ourselves and the ghosts we let sit at the table. The next time you make a financial decision that surprises you, whether it's an impulsive purchase or an overly cautious investment choice, ask yourself, whose voice am I hearing and what childhood memory might be driving this choice? Understanding your money psychology doesn't guarantee better financial decisions, but it's the first step toward making choices based on your current reality rather than your childhood fears and dreams.